What's the impact of self-monitoring for glucose levels?
The health effects of obesity around the world.
How does ADHD affect driving?
And adverse events associated with antibiotic use in the hospital.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on June 23rd, 2017, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine, and actually bicycling in France while the listeners are listening to this podcast.
All right. Nobody's going to want to listen anymore because we're all going to be feeling really jealous, or at least I am. So happy cycling, safe cycling, and let's turn to the studies. Since it's recently the American Diabetes Association annual meeting, why don't we talk about the impact of glucose self-monitoring? That's in JAMA Internal Medicine.
Elizabeth, I found this one counterintuitive. I would have said, why even do this study? Because we know what the answer is. And unfortunately, I would have been wrong. This was a study done to assess the role of glucose self-monitoring in people that have type 2 diabetes in a primary care setting. We would all assume that the individuals who self-monitor, check their glucose on a regular basis, are more likely to have better control of their sugars. I'd even take it a step further. If you monitor that glucose and it's tied to some reminder of what you ought to do, especially if your sugar is high, those individuals would even have better sugar control. So that's exactly what these authors addressed. They took 450 patients who had type 2 diabetes and randomized them to no monitoring at all. Secondly, is they did self-monitoring. The third is they did self-monitoring and they had tailor messages that were delivered via the meter to tell them what they ought to do. And then they followed these individuals over the course of a year. There was no difference in the sugars, that is the hemoglobin A1C, across all three groups. No difference with regard to key adverse events called hypoglycemia frequency or healthcare utilization or even insulin initiation.
Well, that's really interesting, except for I'm not sure it's going to make people, should we say, hey, you don't need to even worry about monitoring?
It doesn't mean that you shouldn't control your diet. It doesn't mean you shouldn't exercise. It doesn't mean you shouldn't take your medications. It just says, for those of us who are physicians that always told the patient, you need to monitor this, we have to take a step back and say, well, you know what? For the population at large, it just doesn't improve their overall sugar. Now, within this group, there'll be some people that just say, I don't care what the studies do, I want to continue to monitor it. We shouldn't dissuade them from doing that, but we shouldn't take all of our patients and say, listen, do this because you're going to have a better outcome because the study doesn't support that.
I find that really interesting also because you may know that there happens to be a robust black market in glucose test strips. And those things are expensive for all of those different devices. And so I would think it would be a profound relief for a lot of people not to have to do it so often based on a study like this one.
And I think you're right. This should force the patients and the clinicians to consider the specifics of each individual patient. Do they want to do it or not? If they're motivated, let them do it. But if they don't want to, if they're going to be counterproductive, then say, you know what, it's okay. It's not that we shouldn't monitor your sugar at all. That should be done on a routine basis. But the self-monitoring of glucose may not be helpful.
Interesting. Maybe we're going to be seeing a dearth of home glucose monitoring here in the future based on this study. Let's turn to the one that concerns me the most this week. That was in JAMA Pediatrics. This was a look at motor vehicle accidents among teenagers who were diagnosed with ADHD.
ADHD, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, as you're aware, it's a very common childhood disorder, but it often persists into adolescence. And this is a time when most individuals learn to drive. The defining symptoms of ADHD include things like inattention and hyperactivity, impulsivity, things that may not be such good characteristics when we're trying to teach someone to drive. So what these investigators attempted to do was to examine the association between ADHD and both driver licensing and crash involvement. Did individuals with ADHD tend to get their license more or less frequently? Did they tend to do it later or not? And was there any relationship between this disorder and involvement in crashes? So this is a retrospective cohort study conducted at 6 primary care practices at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. They looked at over 2,400 adolescents and young adults with ADHD and compared them to almost 16,000 without ADHD. And they followed them until they were about 25 years of age. So they had their health records, and they also looked at the motor vehicle accident reports as well to try to pair them up. Compared with individuals without ADHD, individuals with that disorder were less likely to get their license, about 35% less likely to get a license. And if they did, by the way, they usually got it a little bit later. Unfortunately, they were more likely to be involved in automobile accidents. 43% of the adolescents with ADHD were involved in a motor vehicle accident, compared to about 36% without ADHD. That didn't vary by gender, it didn't vary by license age, or even over time as well.
I guess the study I would like to see is what happens as these people age. So what is the rate of motor vehicle accidents among all those adults out there who have ADHD? And then what's the rate among those who are on medication for it and are otherwise symptomatically well controlled?
All right, two good points. Let's address the first. You and I both know that many of these individuals were diagnosed with ADHD as kids, and they kind of outgrow it. The question is, do you outgrow this increased risk of motor vehicle accidents? We won't know that until we look at middle age. The second question is, only about 12% of these kids were taking medication at the time, and it didn't seem to alter their risk of having automobile accidents.
I'm terribly concerned about this because, as we know, and you've already identified, the rate of motor vehicle accidents among teenagers is already high, and anything that would exacerbate that seems to me to be something to be concerned about and to try to strategize on ways to control it.
Yeah, and so we need to kind of look at the mechanisms. What is it? Are they distracted? Are they using cell phones? What are the mechanisms responsible for this so we can begin to influence it?
Still in JAMA internal medicine, what about antibiotic use while someone's in the hospital and adverse events?
Approximately 50% of hospitalized patients receive at least one antibiotic during their hospital stay. It's estimated that about 20 to 30% of the inpatient days of antibiotic therapy are actually considered unnecessary. But there's not a whole lot of data with what the adverse events associated with hospitalized patients. So the investigators attempted to answer this by looking at the medical records of almost 1,500 patients who were hospitalized and received antibiotics. And they looked at the adverse events not only during the hospitalization, but for up to 30 days. Because some of these adverse events may not be immediate. It may take a week or a week and a half or two to become manifest. We're talking about gastrointestinal issues, dermatologic issues like rash, musculoskeletal issues, even C. diff. In these almost 1,500 patients, 20% experienced at least one antibiotic-associated adverse event. And about 20% of these antibiotic regimens were not indicated. For every additional 10 days of antibiotic therapy, it conferred a 3% increased risk of having an adverse event. So although antibiotics can play a critical role in hospitalized patients, we need to be aware that about 1 in 5 patients are going to have an adverse event related to that.
I think that this first 30 days afterwards is particularly compelling since we're trying to reduce the rate of rehospitalization and clearly is one more factor that needs to be weighed with regard to antibiotic use at all.
Yep. And so let's make sure if we're going to prescribe them that there's a clear indication for them and we use them for the shortest period of time necessary.
Let's turn to our final one now. And that is in the New England Journal of Medicine. We can't get away from this no matter what we do. What about the obesity situation worldwide?
Unfortunately, we spend a lot of time talking about obesity. On the one hand, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but this study is absolutely amazing because of the breadth, no pun intended. They examined the health effects of overweight and obesity in 195 countries over 25 years. They analyzed data from over 68 million persons to assess the trends in the prevalence of overweight and obesity in children and adults from 1980 to 2015. In 2015, a total of 108 million children and 604 million adults were obese. Since 1980, the prevalence of obesity has doubled in more than 70 of these countries. That's both in developed countries and in developing countries as well. In many countries, childhood obesity is increasing at a faster rate than adult obesity. If you just look at how this affects health worldwide, being overweight or obese accounted for 4 million deaths globally. More than two-thirds of these related to cardiovascular disease.
I'm not even sure if there's anything to add to that. It seems to me that we've examined this issue from so many different perspectives, so many different times. Clearly, it's got to be a policy level agenda item that needs to be taken care of with a whole constellation of interventions, including things like built infrastructure and subsidies for food and education and so forth, because it really is everywhere.
Yeah, I found it kind of fascinating. In the countries that have high incidence of malnutrition, they also saw increasing incidence of obesity at the same time. Think about this, 4 million deaths annually attributed to just being overweight. We can control that. What it takes is controlling our food habits and our exercise as well. We could save potentially 4 million lives by decreasing people's weight. That's pretty amazing.
On that note, since you're going off to exercise, I wish you safe travels and safe cycling. I am going to discuss the motor vehicle accidents and ADHD on the blog this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.